Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path Radio Broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 each weekday afternoon, Pacific Time. And if you'd like to be on the program, let me give you a toll-free number you can call. If you have questions about the Bible or maybe a difference of opinion from the host and would like to express that, feel free to call me at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And we have one line open right now. However, first we're going to talk to Bob calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Thank you. I'm very confused about the different ages. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. What I've heard so far is that God, during the first age, created man and all the races, but we were in spirit form, and then the second age started with the Garden of Eden and Adam and the key of David and the genealogy, and I'm just so confused.
Well, the reason you're confused is none of that's in the Bible.
That's what I was going to ask you.
You
know, when you hear it from a certain perspective, you know, it's kind of easy to say, okay, well, that's what that word meant, or that's mm-hmm. what...
Are you hearing that from somebody on television?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I would say that that person is making stuff up out of whole cloth and is not a reliable Bible teacher.
Yeah, but when I heard it, it made sense why the scientists can age the Earth at such phenomenal years, like millions of years, and yet our history starts in Genesis, and that's just a few thousand years ago.
Well, it sounds to me like the teaching you're talking about is called the gap theory, and that what it is saying is there was an age before the creation of Adam, and that age was on this earth, but it was before any of the creation events that we read of in Genesis chapter 1. In other words, except for verse 1, which says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." Now, the gap theory is that at that point, God created a whole bunch of stuff that's not recorded in Genesis. And there was a whole society, and there were people, and there were dinosaurs, and there was the devil there, and so forth. And then bad things happened. God had to judge it. It got overflowed with water. And then God began again in Genesis 1-2, where it says the earth became or was formless and void. They say that that's not the original condition of the earth. They say that's actually a condition that came about because God judged the earlier society that was there. And then when we read of the 6 days of creation in the remainder of Genesis chapter 1, we're reading about really a recreation because there was an entire creation and an entire history, and a pre-Adamic history that existed and ran its course and suffered judgment before any of those things that are recorded there.
That's kind of what I heard.
Okay, now none of that is taught in Scripture.
I see. I just tried to read Genesis again, and it says that he created man in our own image, and then it goes right into he's going to, I forget the exact word, but he's going to name all the animals and be at like top of the food chain. He will dominate all the...
Right. I mean, yeah, the Genesis one is very easy to understand if you don't...
Not for me.
Well, no, if you don't bring somebody else's teaching into it.
That's what's clogging up my work.
I mean, a child can read Genesis 1 and understand what it's saying, but if he's trying to find secret ages that aren't mentioned and trying to fit them in somewhere, that's going to confuse him. Well, why bother? Why go for that confusion when you can just read the Bible for what it says?
Well, I've also heard that when God said he made the earth and then his spirit moved over it, I've heard that the spirit is Jesus. And that God...
Well, it's the Spirit of Christ. The Holy Spirit...
The earth.
Yeah, the Holy Spirit is the Spirit of Christ. There's no distinction between the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Christ.
I know that the Trinity is a whole nether source of confusion for me.
Right.
I trust that it is.
Right, that's the best way to go on that.
Okay, so I'm falling prey to stuff that kind of makes sense, but there's no proof of it in the Bible.
Well, it kind of makes sense, but it actually is against what the Bible says, because if you look at Exodus chapter 20... in verse 11, It's when God is giving the Ten Commandments.
20, verse 11, okay.
That's in Exodus now. Exodus 20 and verse 11.
20,
God is giving the Sabbath commandment, and he says, "For in 6 days the Lord God made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them."
Boy, that
and he rested. But that covers it. From what point to what point? From the point where he created the heavens and the earth, that was included in the 6 days, right? He said, "In 6 days the Lord created the heavens and the earth and the seas and everything in them." So that means Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, which says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," that happened within the 6 days. It didn't happen billions of years before the 6 days.
Boy, I'm way off the mark, and I'm still confused.
Well, you'll get off the mark if you listen to certain teachers, I'm afraid, and it sounds like the teacher you've been listening to, if he was bringing in the key of David in that situation, then he's got some kind of esoteric teaching that's not related to anything
no,
the Bible teaches.
I understand that the second age is when Adam and the garden, and then God starts from Genesis. That's what I've been hearing, is that starts the second age, and then we can, follow along from there. But
well, that's not biblical teaching. So I would say that the teacher you're listening to is a good one not to listen to, I think, because he's making stuff up.
That is so mind-boggling to me who to listen to, because I'm having trouble interpreting the Bible. I just don't know where to go.
Maybe the best thing to do for the next year is read through the Bible twice without listening to anybody.
Okay,
don't listen to me, don't listen to anybody. Just read through the Bible twice. You can read it, if you read 6 chapters a day, you'll get through the whole Bible in 6 months. And because you'll be reading it at a pretty fast clip, it won't be as confusing. Because when you read it real slow, you're trying to analyze every little detail, and it takes forever to get it in its perspective. It's like trying to examine the trees and missing the whole forest. If you read through the Bible quickly the first couple of times, then it'll make sense to you when you read it more slowly, because you will have the big picture of what the whole Bible is teaching from having read the whole thing.
I'm going to try that, because when I get stuck on a word, I think, you know, I'm obligated to not go any further until I understand it, and that, I think, is what my problem is.
I think you're getting confused from hearing too many teachers, and I'm one of them you're hearing. And, of course, I'm saying something different than what someone else is saying, and that's just confusing you. So you'd be better off just prayerfully reading the Bible very, very intensely. And, if there's things you don't understand, don't worry too much about it. The first time or two that you go through, there will be plenty of things you don't understand. But if you don't get discouraged, and if you continue reading again and again and again through the Bible, and don't ever feel like you've read it through enough. I've read through it over 30 times, and I haven't read through it enough. And my hero, George Mueller, read through it over 100 times and hadn't read through it enough. You can read through the Bible the rest of your life again and again and again, and you will see more and more clearly. And the parts that you don't see clearly, especially on the initial readings, don't worry about them. Because in most cases, the part that is confusing when you first read it, it may be explained in the later parts of the Bible once you get there.
But context.
Yeah, so get the big picture first.
Okay, Steve. Thank you so much.
Okay, Bob. God bless you.
Keep plugging away. God bless you.
All right. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is my friend Brad from Kuski, Idaho. And I'll bet, Brad, you're gonna ball me out for what I said to Stan yesterday.
what I wanted to say about that was by exposing corruption in government, you're not really, you're not playing on a fear thing. Do you remember how you kind of said that that Stan might be being fearful?
Uh-huh.
You know, and so I think that's a big problem with guys like Stan, that they get frustrated with preachers because they say that they're being fearful. Like an analogy that I can think of is this. If a woman comes up to you at the next day and says, you know, there's somebody bugging me at night, and you say to her, oh, don't worry about it, it's just fear, you're just fearful. You see what I'm saying, Steve?
Yeah, but see, what if the woman says, you know, I'm fearful because bombs keep going off near my house, and I'm afraid one will hit my house, but there's nowhere I can go, I have to stay home with my kids. then I would just say, well, don't be fearful. There's not anything you can do about that. Now, if there's somebody bugging you, you can call the police. If the police are corrupt, who do you call? You know, I mean, when Stan tells me that, you know, we've got problems with chemtrails, I agree. I agree there's a problem with chemtrails. But who are you going to call?
Well, I think what where Stan's coming from, and I want you to know, I think Stan makes a mistake by mixing aliens in and stuff like that with it. And in that case, you can't do anything. But I do think that if enough Christians demanded our government to be accountable for chemtrails, then our government would become accountable.
And do you think it's our government, though, Brad?
Oh, yes, because it's easy to trace it to our government. That part's easy. There's a whole bunch of declassified documents that are available.
Oh, what I mean is, first of all, I don't doubt that it's government. I just wonder if it's our government.
It is. It's the Anglo-American banks who control our government along with the British government and a few other European governments, specifically France.
Because I've seen chemtrails over Sweden.
Right. Because they pretty much, the banks, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank, they pretty much control the world. I mean, they're the Anglo-American banking system is bombing seven countries right now with American bombs.
Yeah.
I'm just saying this. If American Christians started exposing that, it would come to a stop, I believe. And I think that's where Stan's coming from, where he's frustrated. Because we tend to see, I mean, I totally disagree with Chuck Missler about this crazy stuff. But I'm not I think that is Satan's way of mixing this bizarre stuff into something that we can really do something about. So,
I'm for it. I'm for doing something about it, Brad. I just don't know what can be done. I mean, raising the awareness of people, is that going to make, you know, the Rothschilds surrender their agenda or what?
I think it will, because I don't know if you know that there was a Bilderberg meeting in Switzerland just last week.
Mm.
And the awareness level is really rising, and they kind of got scared out of there.
Mm.
So awareness is a critical part that I believe the church is failing on. You know, and so I think that's where Stan's coming from.
I see. Well, Brad, I know that you're more knowledgeable about this than almost anyone I know, and you and I have had our discussions, and you're a little upset with me because I don't get more politically active than I am, and I don't necessarily advise it. But
I'm not upset about that. No, here's what I'm upset about is to say something like that you're fear mongering. I don't believe it's fear mongering to expose corruption.
Brad, I actually don't mind hearing Alex Jones or Stan Monteith and some of these people expose these things. I think it's interesting, but all I know to do is to pray about it. I really don't. If there's an international world government doing things, I don't really know where to go, send them an email of complaint.
Right, and I agree with that. I just don't agree with the idea of saying that it's fear-mongering. That's all. That's really... Because I believe that you are a great man in today. I mean, I have tremendous respect for you, so I'm not jumping on you. I just don't think that we should always just throw this stuff off as fear-mongering. Like, look, just another example about that is right now in America, and you can get this online, it's just right out there, it's something like 60 new babies in America are coming, especially, you know, baby boys are coming down with autism.
Hmm.
And yet if you try to expose that it's very much connected to vaccines, I think that's a job of Christians to expose that and not just call it fear mongering. And I bring that up because, you know, Stan even brought that, you know, he brought the vaccines up yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brad, let me tell you where I stand on that. It may be that the people who should be, you know, leading social change, I mean, the ones who have perhaps the mandate and the incentive or whatever to do so might be the Christians. That's not the same thing as saying the preachers have it as their message to preach that. I mean, as far as, for example, the preachers are there to preach about how to obey Jesus, okay? But and they need to be expert about how to obey Jesus. They need to be expert about the Bible, if possible. But they can't be expert about everything. So let's just say there's something like they're putting fluoride in the water, and that's a bad thing. Well, the preacher, in order to know whether that's really a bad thing or really just some kind of a hype, needs to go out and do a ton of research. That takes him away from what he's supposed to be doing. I mean, the apostle said it's not even right for us to leave the Word of God to go wait on tables, and that was helping the poor. You know, they appointed someone else to do that so they could concentrate on the Word of God in prayer. I believe that people expect preachers to do the whole job of the church. And, you know, now Alex Jones is not a preacher, but he's doing a job. He's doing research and he's getting information out there. More power to him if he's right. But see, the point I'm making is that there have been, I mean, if you go online and look this stuff up, you're going to hear people saying, you know, chemtrails are, you know, killing us. And another is going to say, no, this is harmless and so forth. Now, obviously someone might have a calling to research that and find out what the truth is. But I think if preachers get involved in doing all that research, they're getting away from what their actual calling is. If there's someone who's not a preacher and isn't there necessarily to, you know, to preach the gospel, but they have another calling of education, educating the public or the Christian public about something, that's fine with me.
You're right. But see, what I've witnessed is the preachers make fun of that stuff. And I think that's where Stan's frustration is. I think he's confused about Chuck Missler and stuff. But I still think there's a frustration level where so many preachers actually try to talk you out of even thinking about it.
But, Brad, you know me. You know I take all those things seriously.
Right. And most Christians don't.
The thing is that Stan, when he called, he was saying, like, I'm trying to hide this from my listeners.
Right.
Nonsense. I don't hide anything from my listeners.
Right. And I want to. And I disagree with that, that statement that Stan made, because, you know, I agree with you. But now, you mentioned the Bible. Let's go to Exodus chapter 18, verse 21, where Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, specifically tells him to find people that are of good character. They hate covetousness. They hate unjust gain. So I do see a role for a preacher to make these kind of statements that deal with justice out there, you know. So,
well, I mean, every preacher should advocate justice. There's no question about that. The question of whether vaccinations are causing autism or not is something for experts to figure out. And the truth is, I've heard it for, 30 years or something, that vaccinations cause autism. I've also heard, you know, probably government-sponsored programs, I wouldn't be surprised, saying, oh, no, that's a bunch of bunk, there's no connection. Well, the thing is, I don't know who to believe unless I go to I would have to make it my project to research that and say who's lying, who's not, and that's not my project.
Well, I'll tell you what, Steve, I have a whole bunch of kids, and I have to earn a living every day, and I can figure this stuff out. It's not really that complicated.
Well, you can, but, I mean, that's your passion, and that's your project.
God bless us with an amazing amount of knowledge, especially with the Internet.
Yeah, I don't have time to spend my whole day on the Internet. I'm actually spending my whole day doing other things that are related to my ministry.
And I don't do that either. I don't spend my whole day. Hey, so there's another thing I want to say about your teaching. I'm listening to Exodus right now, and that you teach last year. Now, here's where a statement that I think you're doing wrong too is, like you say that when Oliver Cromwell became the leader of England, that it became a Puritan government. You know,
Puritan law was instituted.
That was not the case. That's not the case. I think you should study that. What he brought was freedom from the Catholic Church, and then also you say this when Constantine became the leader. All Constantine did. Now both of my statements are from John Fox. So if you study John Fox's Acts and Monuments, he talks about both of these men. And when he talks about Constantine, he says all Constantine did was bring religious freedom. He stopped the state-sponsored persecution.
I agree. I agree with that about Constantine.
So he didn't bring in, like, in your chapter 20 of Exodus, you say that in your teaching just a year ago, you say that he turned the government Christian, and that the history doesn't bear.
Well, he was the government. He was the emperor, and he became Christian.
Chapter 18 of Exodus, we see that there was, 600 judges. Well, that's the same thing with Rome. I mean, there was a huge amount of people in government. So he didn't just change government. And actually, in what John Fox considers Constantine a martyr, and John Fox says that the blessing of Constantine was 1,000 years went by with no state-sponsored persecution. So from my perspective, the reason why there became this very bad papal church in Rome a few hundred years later was because the Christians, just like they are in America today, they're extremely lazy. So rather than blame it on Constantine, I blame it on the lazy Christians that don't care about standing for justice. They don't care, really, enough to research that one kid out of 60 has autism. So I think it's a duty of ours. And then with Oliver Cromwell...
Brad, hang on. One moment. So every Christian should study vaccinations, chemtrails, fluoride in the water, and every other thing that is...
No,
what's that?
But every Christian should stop bad-mouthing those who do. And I'm not saying you do, but I'm saying that it's very prevalent in our society to just teach, for Christian leaders to teach their people to just ignore this stuff. And I'm saying that the blessing of our founding fathers was they didn't ignore this stuff. And now we live in a society where the Christians do, so we're losing the blessing of our founding fathers. Just
yeah.
Like in Rome, they lost the blessing of Constantine. The Christians lost the blessing of Constantine because they became fat and lazy. And same in America. I'm saying it doesn't take that much work to study out why one kid out of 60 in 2011 has autism. It doesn't take that much work.
Well, you know, Brad, I have a fair idea how much work it takes to study all these things out because I've tried to do some research on each one that I've heard about, and I realize there's so many different sides that I not only have to read what's written, I have to go back and see what the credentials are and what the agendas are and what the prejudices are of the people writing them. And I don't have the time to search all those things out. I'm actually seeking to search the scriptures so I can teach people that because that's my calling. I don't deny that there might be people whose calling it is to become experts at, you know, how to cure cancer or how to discover the problems that fluoride in water is causing mercury in vaccines or whatever. I mean, those are not the things that are the calling of the minister to specialize in. Now, if the information comes readily to hand, if there's unambiguous information about evils that are being done and there's no authoritative rebuttals that one should consider, then the preacher might easily say, well, this is a great evil in our society that everyone should see as an injustice.
And I guess where we disagree is I believe the information is readily at hand. But most Christians do not want to look at it. They just refuse to look at it.
So okay.
Disagree.
Well, Brad, I'm never gonna win an argument against you about history. You're one of my expert consultants.
Hey, but you're my favorite Bible teacher, and I absolutely love listening to you. One last thing. I think if you're a little bit closer to your mic, you won't have so much echo in it. I don't know if I'm right about saying that.
Well, I'm pretty close. My mic is on a boom that's right less than an inch from my mouth. I think what it is sometimes it's the technology we're using to connect.
And I'm talking about on your recordings, because you're recording your teaching right now in Seattle.
Oh, you mean in the teachings? Okay. Yeah, well, I understand that, yeah.
I'm listening to last year's teaching right now,
mm-hmm.
And there's a little too much echo in it, and I'm just letting you know that. But.
Yeah, that has a lot to do with the acoustics of the room, but I'm afraid that's partially going to be there no matter what I do, but I appreciate the suggestion.
Okay. Well, you take care, Steve.
Okay, Brad, great talking to you. God bless. All right, we'll talk to Louise next, who's been waiting a long time, from Bothell, Washington. Louise, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Yesterday was my day to learn patience. I have to compliment you on your patience and your gracious ways of answering people. And I think the last caller had a very valid point, but I think your point of saying that it's up to others to research all this stuff, that you don't have that time, I totally agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I don't know how to research, because like you, sometimes you don't know who to ask. And
right.
that's you're the first person that I thought of to ask these questions, and I don't know if, you know, if you want to, if you even know, but my friends, some of my friends and I, we don't know who to ask about things like, is it valid, is yoga exercise valid considering its origins, and what about things like hypnotism, and the other one is acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where to go to find answers to those things. So
right.
You're the first person I thought of to ask.
Well, I can tell you, I can address those subjects, but not as an authority. I mean, I've certainly read and heard and talked to a lot of people involved in those things on both sides of the issues. That is, there are Christians who say that yoga should never be practiced by a Christian. There's others who say, nonsense, it's just stretching exercises. There's some people who say that acupuncture, because it comes from the East and it presumes the, you know, the seven chakras of the body, which is an occult or Eastern idea, you know, it's evil, we shouldn't do that. And others, I know Christian acupuncturists who say nonsense. Likewise with hypnosis, a lot of psychologists use hypnosis, but a lot of Christians would say it's not, spiritually, it's not a safe technique. In other words, no matter what I say, I'm going to make somebody mad at me. Now, I don't mind making people mad. I don't mind making people mad at me. I've done that often enough, but I only want to do it when I really know what I'm talking about. In other words, I don't want to get people mad at me because I said something that I didn't really know anything about. I have another area like that is martial arts. There's a lot of these practices that are, at least if we include martial arts in the mix with yoga and with acupuncture, we're dealing with things that come out of Eastern culture and even Eastern religion. In the case of hypnotism, that's probably not particularly Eastern. It's probably been practiced all over the world. The main thing about the Eastern things is that most of those things are physical things that are tied to a philosophy. The Eastern philosophy and Eastern religion, Hinduism, and its idea that there are the energy fields in the body, and acupuncture, you know, sticks needles in just at the right place to somehow interrupt the energy and do something healing, or at least a pain killing or whatever, is it seems to me that it works. Now, does it work because of demonic reasons, or does it work just because the people in the East discovered something about the human body that Western science didn't figure out? I mean, the thing about most Western medicine, when they look at these kinds of things, is that they say, well, there's no scientific explanation for why this should be. Same thing is true with those therapies that, you know, that press different zones on the bottom of the foot and so forth to heal different parts of the body. They say, well, there's no actual, you know, nerve connections or whatever that so it's not scientific, therefore it must be occultic. Well, I don't know that that's true. I mean, I'm not sure that science has figured out everything there is to figure out. And Western science has certainly benefited us with lots of knowledge, but I don't know that in the East, people without demons involved might not have also discovered some things about how things work. It would not necessarily support the Hindu religion if it so happened that, you know, some of their ideas about the human body turned out to be correct. I don't know. I would say that a Christian, of course, needs to avoid anything that has any overt connection to Eastern religious ideas, particularly the deities of Hinduism. And I have been told, let me just say about martial arts. I know a man who's a preacher of the gospel who for many years after his conversion, and even while he was pastoring a church, he was a teacher of Kung Fu. He apparently did not find anything wrong with that, although he was a godly evangelical man and obviously a black belt in martial arts and didn't find a problem with it. I met another man who was a godly Christian who had been very much involved in the martial arts before his conversion. And he said that you can't really be involved and excel in the martial arts without getting involved in the spiritual aspects that come out of the East from it. Now, who's right? I don't know. I've never practiced martial arts. I don't know who's right. Because of it, I would want to be extremely cautious. Now, the same thing would be true about yoga. Many people say yoga, it's just stretching exercise. It's nothing, you know, nothing spiritual about it necessarily. But, of course, its origins are spiritual. And the stretching exercises have to do with, again, aligning things physically and spiritually together. And some forms of yoga, tantric yoga, of course, is very sexual. Kundalini is seeking to release the serpent at the base of the spine. I mean, these things don't sound very harmless to me, you know.
Yeah,
but
right.
On the other hand, it may well be that there is some stretching that yoga would instruct that doesn't have anything to do with these spiritual ideas. The hard thing is to actually find, instances, let's say classes or whatever in these things, where the instructor isn't into the Eastern things. I've had Christians call me on the air about yoga and say, well, you know, I just want to do it for the stretching, but the instructor at the class is always trying to get us to, you know, meditate or to do these other things or to consider this goddess or whatever. And, you know, I say, well, I'd sooner give up my stretching if there was some question of it's compromising me spiritually. Than to take the chance on it.
My girlfriend was at a yoga class here recently, and, you know, she was thinking, well, maybe the stretching would be good for her, too. And then she said at the end of the class, then the teacher said, now raise your arms and turn and worship the sun. And she said, well, at that point, she folded up her mat and walked out.
See, that's it. It's awfully hard to find, classes and stuff in these things that don't have, where the instructor is not trying to get you involved in their religious ideas. And that's enough to turn me off to it. Now, when it comes to hypnosis, that too is a mysterious thing to me. Some people think that a hypnotist is what is referred to in the Old Testament law as a charmer. And when the Old Testament gives a list of occult practices which Israel's commanded to avoid and to never get involved with, one of the things in the King James Version is the word a charmer, and some modern translations translate a hypnotist. I don't know if that's what it's referring to or not. It might be. It's hard to know, you know, some of those archaic words in the Hebrew, whether they correspond exactly to some of the terms we use for certain practices now. I guess I'm thinking that you'd do best to talk to, if you were interested in one of these things, acupuncture or whatever, see if you can find a Christian who is a practitioner of it and ask them about these things. Because from what I hear, it's awfully hard to divorce these things from their religious and spiritual roots. But it may be possible to do so. I've never tried any of them, so I don't really know if it is. I know that if I was going to try any of them, I would definitely not participate in any of its spiritual aspects, but I don't really know to what degree the spiritual aspects of it, the occultic aspects of it, may be the things that make it effective. My friend who said he had stopped doing martial arts when he became a Christian said that he found that before he was a Christian, he got into the meditative state and all the spiritual aspects of it, and he excelled. But as soon as he refused to do that part anymore, he said he didn't excel. He felt that there's almost a supernatural benefit given to the person who is involved in the occultic aspects or the Eastern aspects of it, which I don't doubt. I mean, there could certainly have been a demonic empowerment given. But he, at least, was one who felt like, you know, the effectiveness of these things is related to your participation in them more than physically, but spiritually as well. If that's true, I would stay far from them, of course. But you'd have to, if you find a Christian who practices those things, I would just ask them all the questions about that and say, you know, to what degree do the spiritual roots of this have anything to do with its effectiveness?
Okay. Well, being pal, you probably don't have the time to go into research on all this stuff, I guess. That makes
well,
sense.
You know what? I have time to do a little bit of research about a lot of things. And a lot of research about a few things. And so I try to spend most of my research time on the few things I'm supposed to be talking about. And then the other things I'm interested in, I do some research, but only enough to get me uncertain about some of them.
Right. Well, at least you can participate in the conversation. But I appreciate the fact that you focus on the word, because that's where we need our guidance the most. And there's not enough of you people out there who who really do study and can be trusted to give us the truth. So I really appreciate that about you.
Well, I'll tell you what, just trying to live by what God said in the Word seems to me like a full-time thing. It's hard for me to think of how do people find time to become experts at other things. Now, if they do, maybe that's their calling. But I just could not devote myself to the things I'm devoted to and still have the time free to become expert in a whole bunch of other things, too.
Right. Well, like you said before, it's the other caller. There's the Alex Joneses and the others who have the time to put into that and maybe
right.
They're calling. So.
Right.
Great. Good for you. Stick to the Word.
Okay, Louise. God bless you.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Yeah. Okay, Rich from Salinas, California. You're next. And we have a line open now for you at 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. And Rich, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. I just want to chime in a little bit of information that I have that you can, when you have time, maybe do a little research on one website. And it's called Wall Builders. It's either
wallbuilders.com
or org, I forget.
Mm-hmm.
And the founder is David Barton.
Here
in Monterey County this past year, there was the annual prayer breakfast, and his son, Tim Barton, came out and spoke, and I have a CD version of that particular prayer breakfast meeting. But in it, and you can probably find this on the website as well, the people in our revolution, when we started this country, before and during the revolution, the lead people were mostly pastors and preachers. And there was a group of students that, in 1816, asked John Adams, what were the most influential people in our revolution? And he'd rattled off names of pastors. And they were Johnson, Whitfield, Cooper, Mayhew, which people we wouldn't know from the revolution. We know Jefferson and Washington and Benjamin Franklin. And there was a bunch of black pastors there, too, Allen, Jones, Rush, and others, that all took the lead before and during the revolution. And Wall Builders is all about our Christian heritage and our country. And our revolution now is to take back our country from the one-world government people. I agree with what Sam said, maybe not on some things, but there is a concerted effort to go after our lifestyle and destroy this country. And so we have to do the same thing here, again, whether it's through an open revolution or whether it's through quietly eliminating people from office, one way or the other, that's what they're trying to do to us. But it was interesting to find that preachers were the lead people in our American Revolution, both black and white preachers. So Wall Builders would give anybody who's interested, Stan and whoever else is interested, a good idea of what happened, what went on. And John Adams said those were the lead people from the students that he questioned him. He didn't come up with Washington, Franklin, and Jefferson. He came up with the others.
Yeah. Now, is that wallbuilders.org or wallbuilders.com?
That I'm not sure of. I don't do computers, so I have never got on the website. I've gotten stuff off the website from a friend of mine with a computer. So it's either com or .org or .com. I'm sure
okay.
Either one, you'll be able to find it real quickly.
Well, Rich, thanks for that information.
It'll give you a real thumbnail sketch on it, and you won't have to do a bunch of research, and then you can see what you find there and go from there. How we get involved in it.
Thanks for the resource.
Okay, thanks for the program too, Steve.
God bless you, Rich. All right, our next caller is Eric from Portland, Oregon. Eric, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
My question is, I wondered if you had an opinion on the concept of theonomy and how it relates to government. And I'll just hang up and listen for your answer. Thank you.
Okay, sure. Theonomy is a word that's taken from two Greek words, theos and nomos. Theos means God, and nomos means law. So theonomy speaks of the law of God. Now, the movement that's called theonomy is part of what's sometimes called the Christian Reconstruction movement. The idea behind it is this, that God's law, which he gave to Israel in the Old Testament, particularly the civil laws that governed, criminal justice, so that the courts were told if a person does such and such crime, give them such and such a punishment. There's lots of laws like that in the Old Testament. And the people who advocate theonomy argue like this, that it is the government's duty to uphold justice. And a primary place where justice is upheld is in the laws that are made and the way the laws are enforced. And therefore, they say, the most just possible way that a government could make and enforce laws is the way that God told Israel to do it. Since God is always just and never is extreme, and he himself said that his own laws were as righteous as any laws anyone's ever received from, you know, any country has ever had. And therefore, the argument is we should look at those civil laws of the Old Testament that Moses gave and adopt those essentially as the norm for legislation and criminal justice. And therefore, they're saying that every country ought to apply those laws. Now, the Christian Reconstructionists, who are the advocates of this theonomy idea, they are also generally post-millennial. Now, what that means is they actually believe the time is going to come, maybe not too far in the future, but they don't commit themselves to any time frame. It could be a long time in the future as far as they're concerned, but they believe the Bible predicts that someday all the nations will be converted and essentially everyone will be Christian. Now, what that would mean, if that does materialize, is all the educators will be Christians, all the police will be Christians, all the plumbers will be Christians, all the electricians will be Christians, all the airline pilots will be Christians, all the legislators will be Christians, all the presidents and kings will be Christians the world over. Now, if that's true, they say, then legislators who are Christians will have to know how to legislate righteously, and they would do best if they would consult the civil laws of the Old Testament to make civil laws for every nation. So what they are saying is, of course, that the laws of God are the best laws that any nations can have. And when the time comes that Christians come into the place of being the legislators, they will, of course, have to make laws that are just, and therefore they should follow the civil laws of Moses. Now, I don't disagree with anything in that argument as I've just presented it. As far as I'm concerned, a person who's in the position of a legislator has to legislate. And if they're going to make laws, they should make laws that are just. And I don't think there's a better standard than the law of God for what justice is. It is the government's role to do the just thing. And also when it comes to criminal penalties. For criminal acts, it does seem, in fact, that we should consult God to see what a criminal act deserves in terms of penalty. Now, there are some sticking points, though. I'm not a postmillennialist myself, and I don't, therefore, believe that we will ever necessarily in America see what we call a theocracy. That's what Israel was. Israel was a theocracy. God was their king, and everyone else who ruled was like a judge enforcing God's laws. We don't have any countries like that today. There are no countries that are theocracies. I suppose the Muslim countries might see themselves that way, but there are no countries, not even Israel today, sees itself as a theocracy governed by, you know, the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and of Jesus Christ. And therefore, that raises questions about some of the laws in the Old Testament. For example, in the Old Testament, a person could be stoned to death for breaking the Sabbath or for cursing Yahweh. Now, those are perhaps important things to the people of God, but are they the kind of things that a secular government, even if it's run by Christian people, should impose on a pluralistic or a secular populace? That is to say, if I was a Christian legislator, would it be my duty to make a law that people must keep the Sabbath or be stoned to death? Well, I don't think so. And the reason I don't is because even if I were a legislator, I would not be a legislator in a country that is a theocracy, governed by God directly as the king, as Israel was. We don't have societies like that anymore. So I would say that when it comes to the issue of theonomy, frankly, I think the theonomists agree with me on that. I think the theonomists, if I'm not mistaken, realize that there's got to be some kind of tweaking, some kind of discerning, some kind of judgment made between which laws should be, you know, carried over into all societies from Israel and which ones, you know, belonged only to Israel as a theocracy. So I'm going to say, you asked whether I agree with theonomy or not. I agree with it in principle. when it comes to its application, I'm not sure exactly how it will be applied. And since I don't necessarily expect a post-millennial vision to materialize where everyone becomes a Christian and all the governments are Christian, I don't know that the need that they see exists. But if I certainly think that Christian legislators, when they're looking at criminal acts that are universal crimes, not just crimes like cursing God, which is a religious crime, but crimes that every pluralistic society would acknowledge as crimes, murder, adultery, stealing, bearing false witness in court, and so forth, laws like that, I think the penalties that are prescribed in Scripture are legitimate, frankly. And I'm not saying that Christians must insist that these penalties be applied, because, again, I'm not, as a Christian, I don't see it as my primary duty to decide how criminals are punished. Paul said, what have I to do with judging those who are outside the church? He said, we judge those who are inside the church, and God judges those outside. But he does appoint governments to be the executioners of vengeance, it says in Romans 13, of God's wrath on the ungodly. So if there are Christian legislators and they're making laws, then I think they should make laws that are right instead of laws that are maybe politically correct. That'd be, I guess, the best way I can give a short answer to that. Let's talk to John from Portland, Oregon next. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I just had a quick question about what English versions of the Bible do you read? Because I've been hearing a lot about the King James only controversy, and, you know, they're recommending the NASB. But, I mean, I read the King James, the New King James, and the NIV, but I've never really read anything else.
Well, I mean, you don't have to read anything else than that if you don't want to. There's lots of good versions out there. I've got about 26 of them on my shelf, but I don't read them all equally.
Okay.
I use the Bible I carry with me as a New King James, but I'm quite comfortable with the King James or with the New American Standard or with the ESV. I'm not as comfortable with the NIV.
Because of later transcripts? Or?
No. All of them are from later transcripts except the King James and the New King James.
Okay.
So, I mean, the newer Bibles, all of them use the what's called the Alexandrian text.
Okay.
And so the King James only people think that the Alexandrian text is bad, and they think that it's a conspiracy, a New Age conspiracy to corrupt the text. I don't see it that way, but they do, and that's one reason they're King James only. But because only the King James and the New King James don't use the Alexandrian text. But that's not a big issue to me. The Textus Receptus and the Alexandrian text are so similar to each other, at least in what they teach, that I can't really see that you'd get different doctrines from one than you'd get from the other, and I'm not sure why it would be such an alarming thing to people. You're certainly not going to get a New Age doctrine out of the Alexandrian text any more than out of the Textus Receptus. So,
what is it that you don't like about the NIV?
It's their translation philosophy. The NIV did not attempt, and many modern translations do not attempt to translate word for word from the Greek and the Hebrew.
I'm listening to it on CD, but I'm reading the King James at the same time. They're changing master to teacher, which I guess is valid, but master to me means a lot more than teacher. You know?
Yeah, well, in all likelihood, the word they're translating is probably rabbi, and it can be translated teacher or master. It's not so much that. It's more that they're not aiming to find an English equivalent word for the Greek word. They're trying to take whole thoughts and restate them in English. See, it's one thing whether you try to find an English word for each Greek word, or whether you simply take a whole Greek sentence and try to say, well, how would we say a sentence like that in English? And then you come up with an English sentence that says the same thing but doesn't use the same words. That second approach is the NIV's approach. It's also the approach of the New Living Translation and frankly, most modern Bibles. I don't care for that approach. I'd rather have a word-for-word translation.
I hear you. Okay, cool. And one more thing about that, the law thing. It's like, I mean, I've been reading the Old Testament again, too, and I noticed that, you know, people, they kill people by accident. They built all these sanctuary cities for them to go to, you know, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, there were six cities of refuge for the accidental murderer. Yeah.
That's nice. These days, I mean, you go to jail for manslaughter. You know,
yeah.
Accidental death, you know.
Yeah, well, the law of God was more just than our laws are, that's for sure.
Thanks, Steve. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, God bless you, John. Okay, last caller of the day, Josh from Felton, California. Welcome.
Hey, Steve, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Hey, I just wanted to call with hopefully a little encouragement for that call that came in about the yoga. Led me to make the call, but it seems to me I hear so many believers that are just kind of caught up with a fear of this or that. And the verse that comes to mind is Mark, I think it's around 10:20. But Jesus gives the believer the authority over anything evil. And with that said, we're called to be the light. So when that one comment about time to worship the Son came up, I thought, what a beautiful opportunity to say the Son of God, Jesus, you know, and in your own mind, just to bring that forward. So hopefully just encouragement that, you know, enjoy life to the fullest, give God thanks for all of it, and fear is not a gift of the Spirit.
All right, I appreciate your call there. You know, my approach to that is that even though we do have authority over evil spirits, it would not necessarily be the case that we should go into a seance or some other thing that we're forbidden to do, which the Bible refers to as, you know, an occultic practice. And that's really what it comes down to. Is yoga occultic? Is acupuncture occultic? Is, you know, hypnotism occultic? These are the questions that are hard to answer, because and the reason they're hard to answer is because they do arise out of occultic backgrounds, or at least out of Eastern mysticism and Eastern religious backgrounds. Whether those physical things can be, in some sense, separated from those backgrounds is what is hard for me to know. In other words, if there is something that clearly is a demonic practice, I would not say, well, I'm a Christian, I have power over demons, so I can go ahead and do this demonic practice. I would say, as a Christian, I need to stay away from things that are demonic. And if they happen to attack me, then I have authority over them. Or frankly, I can attack them too, but not in the sense of participation with them. So I'm of minds on whether some of these things are safe or not, only because I don't know enough about them. That's my problem, is I don't know enough about them to be able to tell you these things are always dangerous, or the opposite. Namely, these things are sometimes rather innocent and even just physically helpful. I'm afraid I don't know more than that, and I wish I did. Sometimes I wish I knew everything, but I don't think that's going to happen in this lifetime. But we can keep working at it, chipping at it. That's what I'm here for, and that's what I'm working on in my own life, chipping at that goal of understanding more of the things that are necessary for us to understand to stay on the narrow path. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live Monday through Friday, twice a day, from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. That's the program you're listening to right now. I also do a morning half hour from 9:30 to 10 every weekday morning. It can be heard from our website and on other radio stations. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. And you may notice we didn't take any commercial breaks. We never do. We don't have any sponsors. I haven't tried to sell you anything because I wouldn't know what to try to sell you. I don't have anything for sale. I'm just here to talk to you for an hour a day. And if you'd like to keep that talk on the station you're listening to, well, we pay for that time, and where we get is from people like you. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. There's a PayPal link there if you want to donate from there. If you don't want to donate, but you just want stuff, there's free resources there galore. Hundreds of free resources. Just take it. You can download them from there. Till tomorrow, or actually till Monday, this is Steve Gregg. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we hope to talk to you again on Monday. God bless.